Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
With exactly 8 weeks left until November 3, Election Day 2020, what is the state of the presidential race? Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal, sitting in today for Paul Jugot. We are joined today by my colleagues, Kim Strassel. Hi, Kim.
Kyle, how are you?
I'm doing well. Hope you had a good Labor Day. And editorial writer, Jason Willick. Hello, Jason.
Hello.
We're now entering the final stretch of the 2020 campaign. 538, the statistics website, analysis website, gives Joe Biden a 72% chance of winning, which doesn't sound great for Donald Trump, but more than 25% chance still. If I did my probabilities right, that's the chance of flipping two heads in a row. Which is not bad. The Real Clear Politics average of national polls has Biden up +7. And if you start looking back at the polls that go into that average, the last one that showed a tie was in April, and the last poll that showed Trump ahead was in February. So still definitely not where you would want to be, especially as an incumbent. But Kim, I think if I remember right, you've said that you think this race will tighten as we get closer to Election Day. And it has a little bit, but you still think that dynamic is in effect?
Yeah, two things. First of all, as you just mentioned, most people don't really tune in to presidential races until after the conventions are over and after Labor Day is over. And we really are in that last 60-day stretch. So we have finally hit it. The second thing that I just would point out, and I'm not one of those people that believes that polls are nonsense or that they're consistently or always wrong. But I would point out that if you go back to August or even October of 2016, the polls all consistently showed Hillary Clinton was going to be our next president. And so I have a little bit more skepticism of them than some people do. I do think it's close. I think the president is still not where he should be, especially as an incumbent. That given what he had done to the economy over the years prior to COVID, and given some of the obvious problems with Joe Biden, his campaign, and the state of his party, those numbers should still in general be looking better for the president. But I do think that there is probably a little give in those polls, and I think it will get even closer as we move on toward Election Day.
And of course, we don't have a popular vote, a nationwide popular vote either. And that's one of the things that was deceiving in 2016 in the polling, the nationwide polling. So if you look at Real Clear Politics, they also have averages for some of the key swing states. In Arizona and Wisconsin, they have Biden up by 5 points. Pennsylvania, Biden up by 4.2. Michigan, Biden up by 2.6. Florida, Biden up by 1.8, and North Carolina, Biden up by about a half a percentage point. So, Jason, I mean, that definitely is a different picture than the nationwide polling, which has Biden up by 7. And if you're Joe Biden and you're sitting looking at Florida, where you're up by less than 2 points, I don't know that I would feel comfortable with that.
Yeah, looking at the top battlegrounds, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Florida, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Arizona, the RCP average has Biden up 3.2%, which is about half from where he was at the end of July when he was up by about 6 points in the battleground states. And it's less than Hillary Clinton was up by at this point in the election, as Kim mentioned. So, you know, the race, if you're just looking at the national polls because of the Democrats' big support in places like California and New York, you're not getting the full picture that it's actually a race in those swing states, 3 points or so. On the other hand, you know, Trump has never been ahead in the battleground states average. He's always been behind, and a lot of it is going to depend on, are these polls not giving us an accurate reading? We have a colleague who talked about, you know, his parents in a battleground state, they're getting so many phone calls, so much mail, they just don't answer anymore. So, you know, it's a question of how well the science of polling really works, especially in this environment where, you know, Trump support is seen as stigmatized. Are there people who don't want to tell pollsters that? You know, I think some of the pollsters have tried to address that since their 2016 error when they called those battleground states wrong and they had Hillary up by several points going into the election and then she lost those states. But it's going to depend a lot on, you know, how accurate these polls are.
And the map also can change. We got to keep that in mind, too. I mean, the state that looks closest to joining the battleground crew is Minnesota, historically a Democratic state. And Trump did not win Minnesota in 2016, but he lost it by only about 45,000 votes. And it's conceivable that he could make that up this year. And another thing we should keep in mind, Kim, is that there's still 8 weeks to the election. I mean, what could change between now and November 3rd? Could we have a couple more months of really nice jobs numbers? Could we have the Trump administration announcing that it's approving a COVID vaccine? I mean, are those things that could change the dynamic, or are there other things that you'd have in mind?
No, definitely. There are lots of things that could change the dynamic. Number one, I think, is going to be the question of how prominent coronavirus continues to be as a daily theme, only because, remember, Democrats made very clear all the way months ago that that was going to be their number one campaign tactic against Donald Trump. They were going to say he was responsible for this, in fact, responsible for lives lost. I still remember Barack Obama during the Democratic convention blaming 170,000 deaths directly on Donald Trump, which is bizarre. The idea that one politician has the ability to stop a germ racing through a country. But that was going to be their main strategy against him. Now, we've seen this second wave begin to recede in the South and the Southwest. And the question, of course, do you have yet another one? If you look at places like New York, which has largely continued to go along without seeing a resurgence, there is some hope out there among people that maybe herd immunity is a little lower than we thought, or there's some aspect of this virus we don't understand, but there's a potential that it begins to recede as a daily drumbeat of news. That gives Donald Trump the ability to talk more on the economy and the recovery. We had some great jobs numbers that came out last week. The other big thing that I think you potentially could be a big changer and we'll see is the debates that are coming up. This is going to be an opportunity for the country for the first time to actually judge these two men side by side on an argument about policy, for instance, which is something really haven't had, especially because of COVID and because of Joe Biden's strategy of largely arguing against Trump, but not talking a lot about his own policies.
Well, I agree, but that the debates could be pivotal here. I mean, if the Democrats have decided their number one argument, as Kim suggests, is the coronavirus, then number two is that Joe Biden is a good guy, a competent, capable guy, Barack Obama's wingman from those years that you remember so fondly. And those three debates, Jason, could have a huge effect. The first one is scheduled on September 29th. The last one is October 22nd. And so to my mind, I mean, that will give President Trump a chance to define Biden's agenda, which is a very progressive agenda. He moved left after winning the Democratic presidential nomination. And two, to give people a chance to see Joe Biden in action and to see if he has some of these rhetorical hiccups that people have been commenting on, to see if he seems like someone who can step into the White House and do the job.
Yeah, the debates are going to be more important this year than most years because of this extraordinary campaign circumstance where, you know, the candidates aren't really out there very much, and Joe Biden especially has not been out there very much. So it's going to be his most intense exposure. I think, you know, once again, the Trump administration and the Trump campaign set an expectation during the convention that, you know, Joe Biden is senile and so on. And he gave Joe Biden an easy opportunity to beat expectations merely by appearing, you know, passable, giving a passable speech. And I wonder if some Trump people have their expectations too high that Biden will be a total train wreck, so that even if he, you know, loses the debate but gives a competent performance, then that'll be seen as a win for him. But these are long debates, and it's certainly going to be interesting from looking back at the primary debates when Joe Biden was not great on his feet. Of course, Trump has his own weaknesses on his feet in debates, but they're going to be more important than ever before, I would say, because it's going to be one of the most prominent times of exposure for the candidate who's largely been running a safe campaign, not going out there.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. And it seems to me, Kim, that Trump's biggest problem is what he struggled with all along, which is message discipline. And a prime example of that is his Labor Day press event. He started out talking about positive job numbers, touting that this is going to be a V-shaped recovery, talking about opportunity zones. But it was a pretty long event. And by the end, he was talking about how the top people at the Pentagon, quote, want to do nothing but fight wars so that all those wonderful companies that make the bombs and make the planes and make everything else stay happy, unquote. He brought up Hunter Biden. He called Joe Biden, quote, a stupid person, unquote. And it's beyond me to understand why someone in the Trump campaign can't get him to focus more on the message that he wants to win this election.
Well, yeah, but can you name anyone over the last 4 years that has been able to convince Donald Trump to stay on message? And it's weird. He'll go through periods of time where he does. And I've kind of come to note them. It's funny, if you listen to him when he's on the teleprompter, he tends to have this different cadence to his voice. It's almost kind of a little bit more sing-songy. And you can tell he's reading what he's supposed to be reading. But you just can't get him to do it for very long. And that press conference was an excellent example of the problems of that, in that he had some really strong things to relate in the beginning, and they are by far the best issues for the campaign. Talked about the uptick in jobs, 10.6 new ones since May, unemployment numbers dropping. Talked about his plans to end the pandemic and work that was being done on the vaccine. Talked about his promises on how to continue regrowing the economy, whether it was tax cuts or further cutting regulation, cutting new trade deals or opportunity zones for overlooked portions of the American economy. And then all of that kind of got swept away. As he got on riff, he started talking about Hunter Biden, and then he started talking about his disagreements with John McCain over the time and whether or not, yes, there was this military-industrial complex that is out to get him. This just allows the press to go with those issues and print headlines other than the ones that are actually helpful to the president's reelection campaign.
And John McCain came up, I believe, in part because of this Atlantic article, this article in the Atlantic magazine last week, which had some pretty explosive allegations from anonymous sources. So it says that during a presidential trip in 2018 to France, there was a scheduled visit to an American cemetery that was canceled. And then here's a quote from the article. It says, in a conversation with senior staff members on the morning of the scheduled visit, Trump said, quote, why should I go to that cemetery? It's filled with losers, unquote. And Jason, there has been a lot of commentary about this. But how do you think people should, regular voters should take information like that is alleged in an article with all anonymous sources?
That's really hard. I mean, I think it's an example of how, you know, Donald Trump has broken with all sorts of norms and acted in all sorts of ways that you would not expect a president to act. And in the same way, the press has done the same thing. So in this case, you know, the press has its own norms of regulating its behavior. Normally, you know, you wouldn't, without evidence or, you know, without something corroborating, base something on the you know, word of an anonymous source in this way to say. And so, you know, for Trump supporters, it shows that the press is still out to get him and still, you know, ruthless and discarding safeguards as long as it's going to get at the right outcome in a negative story about Trump. And for his opponents, it shows what horrible character he has and how disgraceful, you know, remarks that he has made. I don't think it's going to move very many people. I mean, I do think, you know, that's part of what his, these are supposedly military sources. And I think, you know, that's part of his sense of, you know, why he's now firing these sort of over the top allegations at the military, because he feels that the military establishment doesn't like him. I don't think it's going to move things. I do wonder this Russian bounty story that the Vladimir Putin had a bounty on American troops came out after his intention to withdraw troops from Afghanistan. I think it's definitely true that just like any other bureaucracy, the military does leak stories to further its political interests at a given time.
And President Trump has vehemently denied making those comments. Here's a tweet from him. He said, quote, "I never called John a loser," referring to John McCain, "and swear on whatever, whoever I was asked to swear on, that I never called our great fallen soldiers anything other than heroes." And as a lot of people have pointed out, Trump is on tape in 2015 saying he never liked John McCain because he doesn't like losers. So at least half of that denial has a problem with it. But there's the question is how much do you rely on and trust Kim, those sources that you don't know the names of them? And so for example, the Associated Press and a Fox News reporter have said that they have independently confirmed that those comments were made by the president, but the confirmation also came from anonymous sources. And you don't know if it's the same group of people that are making their way around to different reporters confirming what they told the other guy.
And that's the problem with anonymous sources. I mean, look, this is a bigger problem in the press, okay? Just even 4 or 5 years ago, the use of anonymous sources, it was meant to be something that you used as a last resort, because everyone understands that you need to try to publicly identify sources as much as possible so that people understand where they're coming from and are able to gauge their reliability and credibility. Also, in the past, you used anonymous sources to protect someone. And one of the things that I saw pointed out by another journalist was saying, look, presumably, I mean, these remarks were made years ago. Who's being protected by keeping the names quiet here? You know, it just looks like a hit job in the end. And the bigger problem, I think, for this article is that you've now had more than a dozen people who were on that trip come out and say it simply is not true. So are you going to trust the people that are on the record? And by the way, some of those include folks that really don't like Donald Trump very much, including John Bolton, saying I was there and this just didn't happen, at least not when I was present. So, you know, I think in some ways this could help the president a little bit in that there's not a lot of belief or trust in a lot of the people in the media these days. And there's certainly a theme going around that the press is out to get the president. And you have a piece like this, it's very, very hard to believe it, given the unwillingness of someone to simply come forward. And then, by the way, come forward, put your name out there, and then let your colleagues who are around you say if they remember things that way.
By the way, Kyle, you know, I don't think that it's made up completely. I don't think that the sources just fabricated something, but it's just what's missing is context. And, you know, in a lot of the story, the part that is in quotes is one word, you know, losers and so on. And you don't know really what was being referred to. What was the context? What was being talked about before? Was this a bad attempt at a joke? You know, I'm sure something happened. I don't doubt that Trump has said, you know, extremely rude and horrible things, but you know, it's just a bunch of sort of out of context quotations strung together with an obvious motive of what it wants you to think. So you know, I think there's a distinction between, you know, making something up out of whole cloth and taking things out of context and spinning it.
Another thing that could potentially change the election dynamic is a Trump agenda. So we talked about this on a previous podcast. The president has put out a list of bullet points that he wants to achieve in a second term, but they are very nonspecific. For example, one of them is to cut taxes to boost take-home pay, but no details on what taxes would be cut, who would benefit, how it would be paid for. So some details from the president on what he wants to accomplish, maybe could be used to persuade some voters. And we might get one item this week, Kim. President Trump in 2016 released a list of judges that he would consider appointing to the Supreme Court. He said he would do that again during this election. And there's some reporting suggesting that it could come this week. I mean, do you think the courts is a good issue for the president and motivating for voters in these last few weeks till the election?
I do, although I think for slightly different reasons than they mattered in 2016. In 2016, that list was really important because it reassured conservatives out there that the president was treating this question of judicial nominees in a way that prior Republican conservative candidates had. And remember, at the time, the president was still dealing with a lot of skepticism from a lot of members of his own party, which was very divided on the fact that he was winning the nomination, very concerned that he would govern more like a New York Democrat than he would like a Republican. So the president's picks since that time, I think, have reassured those people. I think they're going to be more important this time for two reasons. One, refocusing people's minds on the stakes of the election, because there's a potential there to point out that this is not just the White House that is at play, but that, you know, there is a very tenuous Republican majority on the court right now. You never know what could happen. And that the next president is likely to make another Supreme Court nomination. If it's, for instance, a Ruth Bader Ginsburg who is retiring, there's a potential to cement a conservative majority on the court for a long time to come. I think there's that. But I think there's also, again, and this is something only if the president and the White House can maintain some discipline, the potential to talk about what would happen under a Biden presidency and a Democratic Senate that is now promising to get rid of the filibuster, a move that would allow Democrats to potentially restructure the courts, to pack the courts, to say, okay, the Supreme Court now, we're losing in terms of our ideology on the court, so it's no longer going to be 9 members, we're going to make it 15, and we're going to give President Biden the opportunity to put 7 new people on there, and Chuck Schumer's Senate is going to wave them all through. I think that that is something that could get a lot of voters' attention and quite quickly.
Finally, there's some talk of a cash crunch now for the Trump campaign. Incumbents generally have a financial advantage, but there's reporting that the Trump campaign has raised $1.1 billion since the beginning of 2019 and has spent more than $800 million of that already. And some questioning of why the Trump campaign, for example, spent money on a Super Bowl ad long before average voters are tuned in. And meanwhile, Jason, the Biden campaign raised $365 million in August alone, which is a new 1-month record for fundraising like that. And obviously, money is not everything. Trump was outspent in 2016, but it's interesting to wonder whether the management of these campaigns could play a role in the dynamic in these last few weeks too.
Sure. And I think, you know, the Biden people, they have a lot of support in among wealthy people. I think Kamala Harris has been probably a good fundraiser among California's well-to-do. And so I think, a lot of people have decided that, you know, people who run companies and so on have decided that, they don't want any more of the Trump show. And I do think that they're going to give Biden a fundraising advantage. I saw that the president is thinking about spending $100 million of his own money. I think that's a red flag for him if he doesn't have enough. If they don't have enough, for example, to contest in Michigan, they have to focus on other states. And that's also going back to what Kim said about the Senate, not just going to hurt the president, but hurt Republican chances in the Senate if the Trump campaign has to pull back and be more selective about where they're spending.
Kim, which way do you think that cuts if President Trump writes his campaign a $100 million check? I mean, Democrats will, of course, say he's trying to buy the election. Republicans will say that he really means business and that it shows that he is a successful person who knows how the economy runs, and it shows that he can't be bought. I mean, writing your campaign a check is a fundraising question, of course, but it's also a political question.
Right. One thing that I just find interesting about Democrats is how none of them are talking anymore about the issues that they were even talking about 4 years ago or 8 years ago, which is how terrible it is that there is even money in presidential politics, and how everyone ought to just take the a vow to not go beyond that federal matching fund that comes out. And that is a long gone theory at this point. And so it would just be humorous, if nothing else, for Democrats to say, nah, nah, you don't have enough money. Look how we're outspending you. That's a big change in my mind, a positive change from a couple of years ago when supposedly money was so corrupt and evil. You're right that both people would cast that check writing in very different ways. But before we get there, I think we need to actually just see if that's even going to be necessary. This piece that originally came out in the New York Times about the cash crunch struck me as yet another kind of classic Trump hit job. They, according to even the New York Times, still have at least $300 million in the bank. They haven't necessarily released their fundraising numbers. We know that they pulled in more than $76 million during their convention week alone. I think we'll just have to wait and see how they're doing in fundraising. And whether or not, you know, the race doesn't end in terms of the ability to raise money on September 1st. We've got 2 months here. And just as with everything else, it's often a time when donors really start to pay attention to, especially if the race is close.
All right. We'll leave it there today. Thank you, Kim and Jason. Thank you all for listening. We'll be back later this week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.